You are old, Father William, the young man said, and your hair has become very white, and yet you incessantly stand on your head. Do you think at your age it is right?
It's like a fog or a mist which lifts at times, but then descends to blot out all the familiar landmarks.
In my youth, Father William replied to his son, and I feared it might injure the brain. But now that I'm perfectly sure I have none, why? I do it again and again.
I can still hear my father in old age muttering in his room, vest, pants, shirt, as he slowly and methodically went through the process of dressing. But I don't think I would ever have followed the path I did without the influence of my grandfather, a widower who lived with us from the time I was 9 until I was about 17. His mind started to fail shortly before my 14th birthday. My mother had persuaded him to put on his best tie and velvet jacket, and quite suddenly, in the midst of my rather proper schoolgirl's party, he astonished us by rising from his chair and proposing a toast and a blessing on the occasion of a union. His actual words were, "We are now about to celebrate the joyful occasion of two people becoming one." And he began to have little tantrums, during which he believed he was still a commercial traveller, as he once had been buying lace around Yorkshire, Cheshire and Derbyshire, and my mother was the boarding housekeeper. But upset by some small thing, he would come downstairs from his room to complain and demand his bill. He would then go back to his room, and there would be a great banging of wardrobe doors, a rattling of drawers, and the pulling down of his suitcases. All this while he muttered and complained. I wanted to understand his behavior, and without realizing it, I must have unconsciously absorbed the concept that it was up to us, the non-old, to find some way of helping them.
Mrs. Carmichael, Mrs. Thomas, Miss Jameson, Mrs. Willard, Miss Dixon, Mrs. Peters, Mrs. Clark.
I trained as a psychiatric social worker in 1950 and chose to specialize in working with old people and their families in their own homes, in hospitals, and in residential care. I did this for almost 30 years. It was actually a retraining for a second career, as I was in my late 40s and had already spent many years as a teacher, first working at my father's school in Salford, and then overseas in China with Arnold, my husband, who was an architect. We had 2 children, daughters, but the marriage didn't last. I ran a children's home in Bexhill and then another for evacuees during the Second World War. But after the war, I wasn't sure how much I could offer children anymore. I was ready for a new challenge.
Such a wonderful view from her very own window of golf links and marshes and blue in the summertime sea.
In the back of my mind, I always knew that one day I would be old myself like my grandfather, but I never imagined how it would really be.
My mother carried on working right into her late 70s. And by the end, she was quite forgetful and not as physically strong as she had been. But we weren't really worried about her until she had 2 falls, breaking her hip twice and hitting her head. And after the second, the fog began to descend.
Your mother, with her mended hip, unmended mind.
I had crossed the threshold. My 2 daughters were now the non-old, and they had to deal with me.
see my ward, said the sister. Proudly took my hand, led me, showed me everywhere. Sluice, kitchen, bathroom. And there in a mist, a thick steam, old women stood together, pink skin glowing, white hair wet. Rosie, dressed in towels, slippers, a cloud from showers about them, bowed from baths. They clambered, sat on stools, dripped.
Mrs. Carmichael,
said my guide, the sister. Naked, wet, red, Mrs. Carmichael came, shook hands, agreed to her name, discussed her prospects, her finances. The interview over, we left the bathroom, its steam cover, entered the ward. Among ladies, one stuck out her tongue like a lollipop. One whinnied, waved.
It was the stories, the histories of my clients that fascinated me. Each night, however tired I was, I used to return to my office and write down every detail of what had happened during the day. My secretary complained bitterly about transcribing my illegible handwriting, but it was the detail that mattered, and these reports later became the basis for some of the lectures I gave to staff and volunteers.
Lost old ladies are thick on the ground. Two a penny, a glut on the market. Each matron is kind, so it seems, and polite and efficient. Each matron despairs, showing room after room of old ladies tucked into armchairs. Old ladies in beds and in baths, propped on walking frames, blind, asleep on commodes, spoon-fed as they doze, settled round switched-off televisions.
There you go, you two.
Thank you, dear.
Hello, no tea, no sugar.
Got it. Oh, you have one for Lydia.
Naomi. Cup of tea.
Put that there.
Is it? It's nothing special. I've made it, look at it.
I remember once on a routine hospital visit, walking through a ward when an old lady stretched out her hands, took mine, and started turning them over and over as if she was washing them. This went on for some time until I must have begun to loosen my fingers and withdraw them, for she then pulled them closer to hers and went on with her wringing movement. Finally, she let my hands fall, gently murmuring, "Thank you, that's enough." Whatever it was I had given her, I knew I couldn't have given it to her any other way.
In a shabby and crumpled front row of fumblers and mumblers, one woman's awake. "I always wanted to lead a noble life," she says.
My mother told us these stories, too. She told them with such feeling that we almost felt as if we'd been there with her. That phrase, "I always wanted to lead a noble life," struck her so deeply that I've never forgotten it either. It haunts me still. All the time her mind was failing, and all the time we were searching for a place that would suit her. We wanted to try and remember everything she taught us about old people and about nursing homes. She even reminded us from time to time in moments of clarity that it was she who still knew best. But we had to arrange for a medical examination to see if there was any chance of her returning home and continuing to lead her old way of life. We needed a second opinion.
The consultant knows he has met this patient before. That she is a woman who had made it her business to understand loss of memory, who would have understood exactly what an assessment meant, and who is still an expert, but can no longer find the words. The consultant feels his youth. But this is a teaching hospital, and he must carry out his assessment, reach his diagnosis, and make his recommendation.
Come along, dear, and come and sit over here. That's it. Are you comfy enough?
Mary sits at her end of the table. She is small, clenched and hunched up, on her best behavior, her eyes watching the faces of her examining board, teachers or parents, questioners who say,
"Good afternoon, Mary. Name and age, Mary?"
"We're all here to help you today."
"What's the day? What's the date?"
Mary tries to work out the year and the place where she is. On this ward, in the afternoon sun, after lunch, half asleep.
"By the way, what was your lunch today, Mary? Who's king or queen?"
"You recall the Prime Minister?"
"Capital city of France?"
Mary cries. She can't do her sums, draw a man, draw a bike. Can't afford to make a mistake. She'll be punished. She has to convey she's a good girl. Please, like and forgive her. She did do her best. Whoever she is, or they are, or why, or what test.
"What I wanted to say to them was, it's not easy, you know, having all those questions fired at you. See if you can remember what day it is today and what date."
She telephones her sister in Australia, trying to ignore the delay on the line, the echoes and odd pauses before her sister replies. They discuss their mother's hip, the assessment, and how, despite her mending bones, Mary is becoming increasingly muddled and agitated. The social worker asks to see her.
"The news for you," the young man said, "is that you have to find a nursing home within a week. I hope that's not unkind. Our hospital has no more beds. There's no more room. And so your mother, with her mended hip, unmended mind, must go. I have a list that you can take, with numbers you may ring and what the cost will be. I think that covers everything. It's up to you. I've work to do, no time to lose. And so, remember, you have just 1 week. Your mother has to go."
Clutching the list, she walks out into the rain, wondering how she will cope with a full-time job and the added responsibility of caring for her mother. How she will have to spend all her evenings, her weekends, her days off, with searching for the right place. And how she and her sister will afford the cost of it all. A juggling act that could last months.
"Short stay or long stay, private or voluntary, family or rest home."
Much later, she notices that the list promises orchards and meadows, groves and dales, woodland and forest.
"Highwood, Homewood, Rookwood and Ivy Lodge, Hazelhurst, the Dingle, the Dell and Grove and Spinney."
The very first sister, reassuring in her hospital uniform.
The very first sister, so warm in her greeting, navy blue, belted and bosomy. Why is she packing up boxes, dismayed at our greeting?
"Make yourself comfy,"
says sister. I sigh.
"Never mind, never mind, never mind. It's your very first home. Never fear, we'll care for your dear loved one here. Never mind, never mind. You've come to the right place, the best place. Your worries and troubles are over, so cheer up. You'll see our family home with its best rooms."
She hurries past boxes and suitcases.
"And then we'll have tea. Come with me. Come with me. Come with me."
She opens the very first door to a crowded room, silent, bare floor.
"Come with me. Come with me."
kind-hearted sister is kneeling and talking to each nodding resident, to the young nurse who reads in the lamplight. Quick, sister is walking busily onward. The next room is worse.
How are you? How are you? How are you?
She shouts to a dozen old men who stand like grey ghosts.
Cheer up, then. Come on, lads. How are you?
Oh, dear, what can the matter be? Dear, dear, what can the matter be?
That was the dining room. Now,
sister bustles down a long corridor,
our private wing.
She opens a door on more silence. No rustles of movement or breathing.
Why didn't you ring? Mrs. Clark? Mrs. Clark? Mrs. Clark? You mustn't sit here in the dark. Just call. Please cheer up, Mrs. Clark. Mrs. Clark? Mrs. Clark?
We're back in the office with teacups and packing. But where are the best rooms? We saw them. Then no. No loved or unloved can come here.
What is lacking? It's really so bad, then.
I can't cheer. I go. Time to go. Time to go. Time to go. Kind sister, who's worked here for years, kneels down to her packing in tears. Time to go. Time to go.
She sees the piles of timber and bags of sand stacked in the front garden as she leaves. They are already building an extension at the back.
Drizzling weather. Here's the second recommended nursing home towering through evergreens. Gravel drive, stone steps, a bell pull, echoes. Far off footsteps come.
Quite early on in my career, I was very struck by an elderly man who had for some reason to go into an old people's home, and after he'd been there for a month, he asked for an interview with the warden in order, as he said, to give her a month's notice. She was surprised and asked him why. "Do you not like the other people?" He replied, "They're all right, if a bit old." "Perhaps then you don't like the food," she said. To which he answered, "It's a damn sight better than the meals on wheels." "Then don't you like me?" she asked. To which he grudgingly admitted that he appreciated that she was doing her best. "Then why do you want to give me a month's notice?" The sluice gates were opened and he burst out. "I'll tell you what, you've given me more baths while I've been here than I've had in my life. And I won't have it." The warden said, "I understand your difficulties, but there's a problem here. I am appointed warden and work for a committee that pay my salary, and one of my responsibilities is to see that all the residents have regular baths. Do you think we could come to some compromise?" After a struggle in his mind, he stipulated that he would agree to a bath every 2 weeks on a Tuesday afternoon. "Not a Tuesday morning, mind. Will that suit you?" The warden said that she was quite sure that the committee would agree to this if it was explained, and with great relief, the old man answered, "Then I'll stay."
Mary's elder daughter arrives from Australia, and together the two sisters continue the search by car. Road map in hand, and a battered envelope folded into the glove compartment, with a trail of possible homes scribbled on the back.
How shall we choose our home? This one so dark, another stately, pillared hall and park. The next is bare and chilly, that one small. Here stairs are steep, and here no lift at all. The homes that seem just right are always full or far too far. More travelling. Some pull our heartstrings. 40 homes. And most refuse imperfect elderly. We beg. They choose.
The family rallies round, and an American aunt flies to London to help with the search.
Just look at the color of those chintzes, and just feel this chair. And what a view from the windows. Oh, I wouldn't mind being a resident here myself.
The proud owners, of course, agree.
A city set on a hill cannot be hid, which explains what we did. We built our crystal palace, our pleasure dome, our bowl, inverted chalice, high on the steepest hill, with our best skill, glass walls, glazed chintz, the kindest staff, until the nicest people, with kin nicely ill, drove in their powerful cars right up our hill to share our view. But this is not for you. We don't have patients who could cause us trouble within our precious bubble, nor muddled folk inclined sometimes to wander beyond our splendor, nor anyone in any way unpleasant, unfair to those nice people here at present.
A cozy old lady reclined on a hill of white pillows. I find that my pink eiderdown and rose-red dressing gown keeps me happy, contented, refined.
Willow Cottage, Orchard House, Beech Lee. As we drove away, we always compared notes. At first, we found ourselves making judgments based on all the wrong things. A hideous pattern on the curtains, brown paint, or a threadbare carpet. It seemed to matter so much if the flowers were plastic and dusty, and whether there was a lingering smell of boiling vegetables and disinfectant. After a while, we realized it wasn't the color scheme that was important. What mattered was the warmth of the welcome, and that the residents were active, not sitting in their rooms like wallpaper. What we really needed was Mary's approval.
I received a telephone call from a desperately worried warden of a home. She declared that she must have help. She had an elderly resident, a Miss Jameson, whose behaviour at the home was intolerable. She was upsetting all the other residents, and most of them now refused to be in the same room as her. Miss Jameson, I was told, had no surviving relatives and was never visited. She had been in the home for over a year, and the matron's final words to me were, "If nothing can be done, she will have to go." This form of behaviour, however, did not qualify Miss Jameson for admission to the psychiatric hospital where I was working, so I arranged to meet her in the outpatient department of a general hospital. To my surprise, I found this thorn in the flesh to be a most interesting and cultured woman. We had barely exchanged civilities when she started to tell me of her life as a suffragette. She told me how she had chained herself to the railings of the Houses of Parliament, set fire to empty cricket pavilions, had been in prison for breaching the peace, and had even been on hunger strike. After pausing for breath, Miss Jameson rounded off this fascinating piece of history by declaring, "You've no idea, Mrs. Silcock, what fun it is to knock a policeman's helmet off." But I understood immediately. I could see clearly how bored she was in that well-run, quiet home. She was unconsciously trying to recreate the drama and militancy of her young life, and figuratively treating the warden's cap as she had previously literally treated the policeman's helmet.
The broom cupboards doubled as visitors' loos. We always felt troubled by broom cupboards doubled with plumbing. Pipes bubbled and steam hid our views of the broom cupboards, doubled as visitors lose.
You all right down there, John?
Yes, fine.
It's just waiting for the water to heat up. Is that hot enough?
No, it's not really hot.
All right, I'll wait for it. It's going to heat up now.
On Saturday morning, we drove to a hospital, kind to old people without too much capital. Four stories up and no garden, impractical. Nobody offered us tea.
Then we hastened through lanes to a place recommended by all the best experts.
Though this we amended.
So sorry, we're closed, said a voice. And they ended with soup of the day at the Lamb. Next they rushed helter-skelter straight back to the city to visit a convent, the real nitty-gritty. So shabby, so happy, so full. What a pity.
We treated ourselves to Mars bars.
On Monday they breakfasted early and went to three jolly widows who cheerfully spent their lives in one room, which was full. And this meant
there was just time for coffee and cake.
The worst place they saw was both crowded and smelly. Everyone squeezed in their chairs watching telly. Some pasty and scrawny, some flabby as jelly.
With one weary youngster in charge.
A run-down old mansion had staff who were fonder of elderly people and let them all wander or help or behave as they liked, which they ponder. On Wednesday, they dined at the Dog.
On Thursday, exhausted, we thought we had found the right place at last. Full, of course.
You two sound,
said the motherly lady who'd shown us around.
As if you should join us for tea.
Wildwood, Bramble Dean, Laurel Bank, and Forest Lodge.
Wildwood, Bramble Dean, Laurel Bank, and Forest Lodge. 41, 42, 43. I ticked each home off the list. Too costly, unsuitable, waiting list, full, counting as we went. The doctor advised us that Mother should attend a day hospital, but she regularly refused to go. We admitted her to a rest home for a trial period, but she adamantly refused to eat, becoming increasingly agitated at every mealtime as she was convinced that the food would poison her. After 2 weeks, they said they were very sorry, but they simply couldn't keep her.
They call it loss of grasp.
It was the custom in the hospital where I used to work that after a domiciliary visit by the consultant psychiatrist, a further visit should be paid by the social worker to see whether any alternative to admission to the hospital was possible. I paid one of these visits to a house on a housing estate in London where large families had traditionally all lived together. On arrival, I found a carefully arranged horseshoe of chairs on which were seated members of the family, and at the apex of which was an old man. I was expected to sit in solitary state opposite to him in the middle of the open part of the horseshoe. I wasn't happy about the arrangement, and I asked if I could speak to the family and to the old man separately. This, I was told, was quite unnecessary, as he was stone deaf and, moreover, had no memory whatever. Both facts I knew from the psychiatrist. Nevertheless, I repeated my request, and I waited while he was propelled to the door, so that I could be alone with the family. After the door was closed, it was immediately reopened by the old man, who turned to me, almost whispering, "Don't let them tell you I'm mad." How did he know madness was in the mind of the family, and that I was the only person who might be able to help him?
It's Sarah. Sarah.
The care assistant.
Sarah. Each day I say my name. Each day it's just the same. At first it seemed a game. I never thought it true. Each day they think I'm new. They ask me, "Who are you?" I wish it were a game. They ask and ask my name. It doesn't sound the same. They're old and glad I'm new and pretty. "Who are you?" they ask. But I'm not true. I'm strange. I'm not the same. My name sounds like their game. Each day I say my name.
You know this one?
The French writer André Maurois, who said, "I find it very difficult to persuade myself that I am as old as those who seemed so old when I was young."
I think it was the horse that did it. Under pressure, we managed to find a new home, recently built and with several vacancies. It seemed to promise everything. And like a fool, I believed them.
Someone sits at the top of the stairs, waiting for someone to come. They promise her friendship and company, craft work and cooking, a library, outings and art and activity. She waits for someone to come. Two people sit at the end of a room. One of them reads a book. She reads aloud with remembered care to a blind old lady who sleeps in her chair and a crowd of people who are not there. Just emptiness and her book.
Soon, they say, we'll have cats and dogs. We might even have a horse. Soon there'll be residents, visitors, throng of experts, an exercise class, a sing-song. Soon, they say, you'll feel you belong. Soon you may feed the horse.
She liked her tea, very weak and black. And they kept giving her tea that was lukewarm, sweet, and milky, and always half spilt in the saucer. It was the sugar in particular that she hated, and she pulled absurd faces to show her disgust. The other rooms remained unused, and she only had one other resident for a companion who was both blind and deaf, and the paddock stayed empty. We took her home for Christmas, and she didn't go back.
"Your time is up," the doctor said. "You haven't found a home? You know your mother must be safe before her mind has gone. You say you've looked. The homes are full. Expensive. Distant. There. You think that you can pick and choose. Just go and find somewhere."
And so they finally placed her in a home connected to the hospital where Mary had once worked, where they thought her old colleagues and neighbours might drop in, prompt her memory. For a while they did, but the visits petered out. Perhaps they were unable to accept the change in her, uncertain of what to say to someone who had always been so interested in other people, and who had always talked so energetically, talked and told stories.
She did have one more story to tell. We arrived to visit her one weekend, and she was quite breathless with excitement. She'd escaped.
and the nurses had had to bring her back.
It was miles and miles.
Her face lit up, thrilled to have such an adventure to tell us.
Welcome! A story!
Words pour like pebbles rushing over a clifftop.
Yesterday morning...
Words blaze and change in falling.
Such an adventure! She made her escape. She pulled high bolts with a stick. She ran miles and miles. But then, someone kind. Such fuss. Such end of freedom.
Well told, old lady.
My sister returned to Australia, but I carried on looking because I could see that my mother still wasn't happy. It still seemed so important to get it right.
The conifers, the poplars, the limes, the pines, the coppice, Copper Beech, Beechcroft, Beech Court.
Evergreen. 44, 45, 46. Summer again, and I have come to our last home, down a leafy lane at the edge of town where children play in the setting sun in its blinding ray. A family home, where the owners frown, they will put our name down, but they have no room, just a waiting list. Sometimes beds become free if I insist, I am welcome to see. Dogs bark in the hall. The husband stands with a plate in his hands while his children call, and his wife and I climb flights of stairs to a room full of sky, which their friend calls hers. A hospital pays for the next room where two people stare. The owner says there is one more room where a vacancy could occur soon. Would I like to see? The room is small. Silent, bare. A table and chair, a bed by the wall, a window above, crowded by trees. Dark leaves move in the evening breeze, and shadow and speckle bed and chair shift everywhere, mottle, freckle, flicker and fade on walls and floor. My hands become shade as I shut the door. I kneel on the bed, look out at flowers. This view could be ours. Trees overhead could be lopped to allow more light, more air. But not just now. There is someone here. A freckled hand lies beside mine and moves as a sign. I understand that this bed isn't free. We must wait on the list. Though our vacancy may soon exist.
Edward sat by the door. Such a gentleman, Edward. He sat in that chair by the door, but now Edward has gone. Arthur never sat there. Louise, though, she sat by the door, nodding and laughing Louise. Louise also has gone. Arthur was really quite young. He used to keep on about pain. Some pain in his stomach, he said. And Arthur was suddenly gone, without any time by the door. Pearl liked him. Pearl sits by the door. They dressed Pearl in Betty's clothes. So Pearl is sure to be gone.
A small girl is sitting on a landing. She's dangling her legs through the banisters and singing, Lily Lally, Lily Lally. Over and over again. Lily Lally, Lily Lally, Lily Lally.
Mrs. Carmichael, Mrs. Thompson, Miss Jameson, Mrs. Willett, Miss Dixon, Mrs. Peters, Mrs. Clark.
Lily Lally, Lily Lally. I'm tired. I'll finish.
Thank you. the visitors say.
Such a wonderful view. From her very own window, of golf links and marshes and blue in the summertime sea.
And, they add,
the food looks quite nice and even smells nice, but we've travelled such miles that we really would like some hot tea.
Also,
she has all that she needs, such as magazines, newspapers, radio, TV and telephone right by her bed.
Furthermore,
she has ensuite facilities, bathroom and toilet, and bell for emergencies, staff room next door to her. We've all said how we wish we could be here instead.
The resident says,
since my spectacles broke and got lost and my cataracts grew, what use is a view? Since my false teeth were dropped down the drain and were washed out to sea, food's been hard work for me. Since my deaf aids keep whistling, my fingers can't fit them, they fall. I don't hear you at all. Since the nurses won't come and the toilet's too far and I'm blamed, I feel so ashamed. The world and its interests and pleasures are all leaving me. Is it too hard to see that I'm bored? I've become such a fool and I wish I could die. I'm sorry. Goodbye.
The staff say,
she gave us a lot of trouble. She used to get very low. But she was an old dear, really. We're sorry she had to go.
If I sit still, or in the night the trees grow tall and dark and silent, I make out this person ahead, walking intently. She's so sure to find the well of the woods. If I shout, she might look up, she might look back, might doubt direction in the forest, call my name. How far she's gone. What crowds in the woods. I can hear a child's game.
"46 Nursing Homes" was based on a sequence of poems by Ruth Silcock and adapted from the lecture notes and case reports of her mother, Margaret Silcock. Mary was played by Rosemary Leach. Her daughter was played by Marcia Warren. The narrator was Anthony Hyde, and other parts were played by Elizabeth Bradley, Adjua Ando, and Sean Barrett. The director was Julian Wilkinson.
The afternoon play, 46 Nursing Homes. And sadly, since the recording of that programme, the actress Elizabeth Bradley has died.